Welcome back to the Pilgrim Faith Podcast, where human wonder fuels the quest for Christian wisdom. Dale and I are just delighted to join you today. Me from Davenant House, where we have all our students for Davenant Hall. This is a really fun place and a really significant place to a lot of people. And Dale, for those of you who recall, runs two campuses in Melbourne County, Florida, and he's at his Melbourne campus today, coming from his school. So us, both of us deep on location in the middle of our projects, coming together to talk today. One of the things I'm going to do before Dale and I have a conversation today, and of course it's related to the kinds of conversations Dale and I have, is talk for a moment about some of the classes we have coming up at Davenant Hall. What I'm going to be trying to do, or what we're going to be trying to do with these podcasts going forward, is just mention as we go along with each of our episodes, one or two of the classes that are coming up. Not to get corny or just go into early, you know, over advert phase, but one of the great things, really, I can talk about this. I think one of the great offerings of Davenant Hall and that kind of genre of communication is that we're not just a degree program, but we're an opportunity for lay people in churches who aren't working toward a degree, but just want to like know something in a convenient way. We're an opportunity to do that in just a bunch of fascinating areas. In fact, the attendees of Davenant Hall have very often been auditors because we're living in this great era. Dale and I have done a podcast about this before. We're living in this great era of lay knowledge in the church. And Davenant Hall really does provide an opportunity for lay people who are like, I just want to know something in a deep way, to have a tutor to just take you a little bit through the tradition. So let me just mention a couple of the courses we have coming up, because some of them I think are really exciting. Josh Shaw is teaching a course on 1st and 2nd Corinthians. And if you had met Josh Shaw, well, most of you haven't, but Josh Shaw, I think, is just one of these New Testament scholars that's really special and has a special range of knowledge to talk about. Actually, two of the most intriguing and complicated texts in the New Testament, 1st and 2nd Corinthians. And so that's one course that actually, if you knew who was teaching it, I think it looks incredibly exciting because those are just such intriguing texts of the New Testament. And Josh Shaw is bringing things to them that I think are really exciting. Ryan Hurd is teaching a course on the mercy of God. Ryan's been on our podcast many times. And those who know Ryan know that he has an astounding knowledge of things, but especially to have that knowledge brought to bear on such a delicate doctrine in the tradition as the question of the mercy of God, which Ryan has devoted an enormous amount of kind of the tip of the spear of his intellect and project to. And so this class on the mercy of God, I think, is just going to be really special. And I highly recommend those who are interested in the doctrine of God to work through.
Isn't he using Anselm? Isn't that what the text?
I believe that's a huge part of what he's doing, is using Anselm for the course. You can correct me if I'm wrong, but I'm pretty sure that is correct.
Yeah.
I should move more quickly through these because I could just wax eloquent. I could spend a whole podcast just waxing eloquent about them. But Male and Female in Modernity by Alistair Roberts. Most people know his biblical work on gender, but listening to Alistair talk about gender relative to modern trends and modern, just the various features of modern life, that's a whole journey in itself. Highly recommend it. Fun courses like a Syriac and Arabic Theology by Charles Carman. Charles is a wonderful intellect, and this is a burgeoning field, just a fantastic field that's really interesting, especially as we're doing kind of the whole rise of classical theism in the Western tradition. It's super interesting to change perspectives and go listen to the Syriac and the Arabic fathers talk about the development of the doctrine of God and to put that into conversation with the things that we're more familiar with. And so,
yeah,
I highly recommend that course. Jim Pachta is teaching counseling and moral theology for us. And like, there's probably no course I'm more excited for. Jim is a wonderfully talented counselor and has so many insights, especially for gender questions and these sorts of things in the modern world. He's been on the podcast as well before, but he's teaching a course on moral theology for all of us, and specifically a theology of counseling, and for pastors or elders or just people who want to know how to counsel people in general life. I think Jim's course is going to be really special, and I'd highly recommend it. And then least recommended, going down a couple rungs on the totem pole, there's good old me. I'll be teaching philosophy as a way of life, which is a really fun course because it's probably the closest thing Davenant has to a history of philosophy, because we start with the pre-Socratics and we kind of look at the emergence of the discourse that we call philosophy, and then kind of work through how philosophy was always considered to be a way of life related to the great things. It's not just a knowledge of the world and its unity in the mind, but a life unified around that knowledge that's unified in the mind. And so there's a philosophy is both pulling the world in its deepest unity toward yourself, but it's also unifying yourself, being in the project of unifying yourself toward the thing. And looking at how various, that's not enough. That's what's interesting about taking a kind of historical approach to philosophy as a way of life, is to see how that you can misinterpret what the unity of things is in the mind, and you can misinterpret how to unify yourself relative to the unity of things in the mind. And looking at the historical version of philosophy as a way of life is this great way to kind of get into the conversation of different approaches. And there are different approaches people have taken to philosophy and the way of life fitted to that philosophy. And there's a distinctive Christian approach. And so one of the things I really enjoy about that class is that you get to teach Jesus and Paul as characters in the history of philosophy. Those who are saying something unified about reality, and those who are saying something about a life ordered and unified around that reality. And that's a really good transition, actually, into what Dale and I have been talking about for the last week or two, which is, I think we've had some conversations floating around this theme of human excellence. And one of the things that I suppose I've been reflecting on for the last month or so is the manner in which the human soul, in its interior movements, just is in a project of human excellence. You might say that the interior fire of being a human is a burning fire which doesn't feel burning enough, unless in some way there is some pursuit of excellence in a manner. And I think we live in a culture, and in a lot of people, there can be the experience of, like, you're not consciously motivated as such by the word excellence. I've heard a lot of people talk about excellence and give speeches about excellence in some way that felt a bit alienating to me. And it was like, I don't know. And maybe, you know, this could be a problem with me, but it's like, but, you know, I don't know that stated as a message reaches into the depths of my soul and motivates me. But then when you stare at the soul, when you stare at the stories that animate you, when you stare at the exemplars, in a sense, that put their hooks in you, there's something in the soul itself that is patterned after an end, a telos, that can only be achieved through the pursuit of excellence. And I think we'll talk about this in the conversation. The New Testament comes in and dialogues with that piece of the human soul, but it's interesting to recognize. It's an interesting piece of the soul to recognize. And the reason it's hard to recognize, and then I'm going to toss this over to you, Dale, the reason it's hard to recognize is that so many people perceive the many, many ways in which their soul is in a state of non-excellence. And so the pursuit of excellence can be very painful, in the sense that you're never Jesus, you're never going to arrive, all those sorts of things. And yet you cannot fully unhook yourself from it as a motivational structure, because there's something in your soul that craves the pursuit of a thing, as it were. Right. And attending to whatever that is in yourself is a really important part of just being a healthy human in some ways. And so that'll set up, I think, many things we have to say about this idea.
Yeah. I think, you know, a couple first things to say are, you know, number one, in our tradition, especially with Augustine and Thomas, what they have recognized is that everything is good. So creation is good, right? And when we say that, we mean that we're really just mimicking or reciting what God said in Genesis after he creates, right? God saw what he made and he called it good. And that is a refrain you find throughout the creation narrative. And then man is very good. So everything is good. And then you have to account for sin. Well, what does sin do? And I like to, when I talk with my students about this, what I say to them is, I start off with the definition of beauty, which the definition of beauty that I use is the shine of the essence of a thing. And then what sin does is it kind of dirties the essence of a thing. So to bring the essence of the thing into more prominence is to make it more beautiful. So, and I think the same works with the good. So when you look at a rose, the rose has thorns on it, and those are accidental to the nature of the rose, which is the roseness, which you really would talk about in the stem and the flowers. And so I say, imagine a rose without the thorns. Imagine how much more beautiful and good that would be. And then you can look at all of creation through that lens. It's like, okay, everything here is good, but it has been, you know, shattered a little bit in the way that we experience it because of the fall. But the soul is always, as Paul talks about in Acts chapter 17, groping toward God, and he is near to us because God is the highest good. So God donates being to things, and therefore they're good because they are. They're good because they exist. Existence is the highest good. God in his own self-existence is the highest good. But insofar as we participate in being, we are, all the things that are here, and they are good because they are here. So they all have a created order that has been in some way muddied or broken, whatever language you want to use, but you nevertheless are moving toward whatever that thing's essence is, or whatever the nature of that thing is, to uncover the way that it's supposed to be. And we call this teleology. So if I have a mound of clay and I'm trying to actualize the potential latent in the power of clay to make a bowl, then my desire is to make a good bowl. And when we miss that mark, which ironically is, you know, kind of riffing off of, to miss the mark is to sin, then you are sinning in your art. It's not a moral sin, but you haven't missed the mark. And what you mean by that is the excellent, the most, the highest good a bowl could potentially be given what it starts out as. So I know I'm kind of disjointed. Let me wrap it all up. Let me tie it all together by saying this. I think what you and I have been talking about in terms of the pursuit of excellence is a recognition in the soul that everything in the world is good because it has a particular end that we need to find out what that end is, and then summon out of that thing the fullness of its end. That is the pursuit of excellence. Given the nature of things, when you can make the essence of a thing shine more, you are bringing it, you're discovering its beauty and its goodness. And I think you just can't help but do that. That is just what we look for, which is why throughout the whole history of humanity, we have people writing about the ideal city, the ideal man. There is an ideal that everyone is naturally gravitating for because they are very good image bearers, to try to discover how to bring out the full potential of all the things that are here.
Right. Yeah. I think that's a really important point. And I think actually there's, in a way, there's different personalities that react differently to this awareness. Like your awareness that there is an ideal city, there's an ideal family, there's an ideal way to be a human. There's an ideal set of habits, there's an ideal of many things. And for some, the kind of conscious image of that is directly motivating. For some, the conscious image of that is actually quite crushing. because you feel the extreme distance, at least in some of those areas, maybe not all of those areas, but in some of those areas, especially if you're self-aware, right? You feel the extreme distance between whatever that is in yourself. Jesus is all of these things put together. And if everybody were Jesus, this is what that would look like. Right. But there's such an extreme distance between yourself and that image that motivation by excellence can kind of feel like, well, yeah, but you know, why would I play that game? I'm so far from achieving that. And I'm never really going to achieve that, i.e. I'm never really going to be Jesus. And so why would that be the thing to look at and to motivate you? And I think, nevertheless, as we were saying at the beginning, the human soul just is, in a kind of metaphysically structural way, motivated by movement along the track of some kind of excellence, some orientation that is excellent. And so there's this question of, if you're one of those persons that finds yourself kind of alienated from motivation by excellence, with a nature nevertheless that is firing according to some stratum of excellence, how do you put those together? And I think one of the things that's so fascinating about the New Testament, I think, is that it can put those languages together through its exhortation to humility, because it's the person who can't get over the privation. It's the person who can't get over their distance from the excellence, as it were, which a lot of self-aware persons can't get over. Like if you see your flaws and you see them very deeply, then you can live in a headspace that and see the demand of the greatness of having a soul and see the delta between those two things. You can kind of get into the headspace of feeling like, well, because I can't be that thing, I might as well be nothing.
Right.
That's the only thing you can be. And I'm reminded here of the parable of the talents. The parable of the talents, I think, is quite profound on this spectrum, that there's the person with 10 talents and the person with 4 talents or 2 talents, and there's the person with 1 talent. And the person who feels like, okay, man, look at the spectrum, in a sense, between me and the ideal. What can happen within that headspace is, why even try? Why even try to aim at excellence? Why even try? And this isn't the immediate application of the parable, in a sense, extrapolating from the images. But it seems to me like there's a fitting application here, that there's a sense of, like, if you feel that delta, or if you just are at that delta, you are at kind of the bottom of how much you have to give on a given day or something like that.
Right.
That you can feel such a delta between you and the perfect that the pride in you takes over. And it's like, well, if I can't be that thing, then, like, I'm not, there's no value in anything I do. And it's interesting in the parable of the talents, the exact language in the text, because it's like, I knew you were an exacting man. I knew that what you wanted was this very precise thing. And so, not me, right? And then the question why didn't you turn 1 into 2? Why didn't you aim that way? At least what you do is you say, okay, yeah, maybe I am limited, but I can be in the headspace. And this is what the human nature, now we're transitioning to a kind of philosophical angle. There's something that the human nature craves to, a project that the human nature craves to be in. And if you do not become a conscious participant in that project, then there's something in you that will not actually be scratched.
Right.
And there's something in you that actually is not going to be godly, because godliness in some sense is to aim at love. It's to aim at Christ himself. It's to aim at a perfection in a way, refracted through the face of a living person. And you can be aware that you have a delta between you and that thing, and still aim at it. And what gives you the humility to do that ultimately, of course, is the forgiveness of sins. It's that God removes the guilt and the shame of that delta, and nevertheless smiles and delights in whatever movement toward that end that the human can make, which is ultimately what any of us are doing on this side of tears.
Yeah, and I think as a matter of fact, that is the, I think the project is ultimately not a movement of the will, but the will opening to receive gifts from its maker. And I think that that's an important framing because oftentimes when we talk about achievement or excellence or the pursuit of the good, maybe what's going in our mind, and it's not wrong to think this way. Paul even uses this language in the New Testament when he talks about the metaphor of a race. We kind of conceive of our pursuit of excellence as a movement, an intentional movement of the will towards something, and that's true. But I think like the very first step is just receiving something first, which is to your point, the forgiveness of God in Jesus Christ. It's the forgiving soul that then has this already not yet nature of glorified. So in some sense, we are with God in the heavenly spaces, but we're not yet fully there. We are made perfect. We are simultaneously justified and sanctified. So we're on our way to perfection, but we're already perfected in some way. The way that theologians have tried to work that out, they're all just trying to put language to exactly what you and I are saying. But my point of bringing that up is the very first move is to simply receive. You receive the gift of God, you receive God's grace through the gift of faith, and then you begin to move toward Him. And I was having dinner with a couple of friends the other night, and she wants to be a personal trainer. This woman is she's highly competent. She's an anesthesiologist. She's made it in life, top of her class when she graduated med school. And she wants to move out of that, and she wants to help people be, physically fit. And I said to her, I'm like, when I talk to my teachers about growing in wisdom and knowledge, a lot of them get nervous because they're like, I'm not going to be able to do that by the end of the year. It's like, that's the wrong way to think. You're not going to be able to do this by the end of your lifetime. So millimeter movements, if you can think about the move toward the good, which you are naturally inclined to, given your human nature, which is cut in some sense, can't help but try to return back to its source, which is God. And you measure your success in terms of your current ability to move, then that takes a lot of the anxiety out of summoning up the power to achieve something that you conceive of as good, which actually might not be the good. So then you end up chasing a phantom. You end up chasing you what to use a, Solomon's language in Ecclesiastes, you are grasping after the wind. Because in a lot of ways, that's what Solomon did. Wisest man to live, and he tried everything. I did this, I did this, I did this, I did this, and it was all a grasping after the wind. So this is like when you recognize the delta between where you are and the excellent life, the good life, to actualize your full potential that God has given you. And I really want to talk maybe at some point, Joe, about the distinction between, essence and subsistence, because I think that plays a role in this conversation. You and I were talking the other night. It's like when I move towards the excellence, given the powers that are unique to Dale, to manifest, to sort of pursue the excellence the way that I can pursue the excellence. It has to do with my unique form as a soul and a body, different from Joseph Minnick. And this really is where you're getting at with humility. But anyway, my whole point here is to say the anxiety to at arrival is how you get ideologues and cult in the religious realm. You do not, there's no assuming arrival, or there's no putting a timetable on arrival at excellence. You're just simply on the pilgrim's journey until you die. And if you're moving millimeters according to what you're called to be, then that's a win. That's like moving into the good life.
One of the things we've talked about several times on this podcast is about the relationship between the gifts, this language in the New Testament on the gifts and the relationship of that language to the language of the weak and the strong. Because again, you read these passages about, like, you know, you who are strong, bear with those who are weak. And it's kind of like, who am I? And realistically, with very few exceptions, most Christians are both. Most Christians are the strong, and it's why the New Testament speaks, I think, sometimes in very general terms, because it's so universally applicable. All of you are strong in some way. You have a measure of a thing that somebody does not have a measure of that thing, and all of you are weak in a way. And there's instructions to you in as much as you are strong, and there's in that is bear with those who are weak, and there's instructions to you in as much as you are weak. And it seems to me that this provides a pathway, a very realistic pathway for humans who experience that sense of the delta. There's perfection. Here's where I am. But there can always be the idea of move through your gift. Get enough outside of your head that you recognize one thing. You recognize the smallest thing in which you know how to move and move through that. So if love is the universal end and all the things that are described in 1 Corinthians 13 that are just kind of absolute, and that's a way of stating what we're moving toward in its most universal aspect, your gifts are the particular style of movement that God has distributed in the human race to move toward that end. And so there's a sensation, as it were. There's a sensation inside of you that you have access to orient you toward that more absolute and ultimate end, such that if you can get outside of your head enough and be humble and recognize I'm flawed, recognize I don't have all the things, I need other people, all of that, I can still be styled, as it were, toward the end of something excellent in such a way that my nature is relieved that, okay, we're on the train and we're going that way. And that style of movement is actually a self-possession in a sense of one's own gifts. And the recognition, you know, even if you're one of those humans, and a lot of people are those humans, this is probably the average human experience where that limitation is enormous. And where that style of movement and those places of movement are often very small. This is where you have to go back to the widow's two mites, right? That the woman in the temple who's giving this, what looks to everybody else to be the smallest thing, in as much as she's moving through whatever she has. And I think you could apply that, the spiritual principial aspect of this to the gifts, in as much as even if you have an unoppressive amount of whatever it is and you give it away and you actually give your life away through the things that you have to give away, the Lord sees that, and it might be that, like, you're actually more excellent in his eyes.
Sure.
In some way. You're hitting the mark in such a profound way, precisely because maybe you have a small, but you're giving it away more fully.
Yeah. Yeah, that's good. I think also to just think very practically about this, you know, Joe's class in Davenant Hall, Philosophy as a Way of Life, that resonates so deeply with me. I don't know why that comes naturally. When I think of philosophy, I think this is how, maybe because of my introduction to philosophy was as a layman, it was outside of any institution. I kind of had one tutor. But really it was me reading a bunch of stuff that I didn't understand, but it was always the study of philosophy was always for the achievement of the good life. It was to live a good life, because to be wise, to possess wisdom, means that you are on the way, right? So here's something that I've been thinking about recently. Okay, if we say the job of humanity is to discover the nature and therefore the ends of things, including ourselves and everything else around us, then in the project of movement toward excellence, perhaps the easiest and in some ways the hardest, but certainly among the first movements, should be to look at things around you to see if you can discern what they are and what their purpose is, what their ends are. And that could be in things that are very obvious, like trees, but even the inquiry into a tree, it's like, well, what's the end of a tree? It's to produce, I mean, what is it, right? So you'd have to answer that question. But it accomplishes, even if we say, well, I don't know if I can say there's one end to a tree, but maybe there's 20 that I can think of. Well, it's like, good, because now what you do is you get your mind in the habit of appreciating everything, which we already said was good. And if the mind is in the habit of interpreting everything as good, as something that I should pay attention to in order to discover its nature and purpose, then you're priming the soul, so to speak, to appreciate the maker of all of those things. In his wisdom, God has made manifold good nodal points that function to propel my mind up to him to say, thank you for these things, right? Which just creates a habit of thanksgiving, which is just worship. You know, I say this a lot here at the school. You know, we talk about wonder, worship, wonder, wisdom, and worship. And those three things are principles upon which the good life is formed. It's not enough to be awestruck by the absolute profundity of the natural, everyday lived experience of a human. That's one thing. To even arrive at that spot is an enormous feat when you can properly name things. But then that gives you wisdom. In other words, navigating the patterns that you've detected in reality according to the nature of the things that you've looked at. That doesn't end there. It needs to cash out in worship, which is a thanksgiving. And here's what I have experienced. I'm certainly not trying to give anyone a formula, but what I have experienced is then it's like what I can pursue excellence from a seat of calm, from a peace that comes from God that passes understanding, because you're tapped into God by constant communion via prayer and thanksgiving, meditation. So now it's like, okay, I'm on the path, and my destiny is absolute excellence. And I don't need to sort of run out and accomplish all the things immediately to feel satisfaction. I can feel satisfaction now by just knowing and creating small habits in this way, right? Really, it's just becoming a better worshiper of God that calms the anxiety down, that when you see the gulf, you don't either jump in and you know, unalive yourself, or check out from the project altogether and just say, man, I'm not interested because that's too much.
I was talking to a group of young undergraduates this last weekend about the good, the true, and the beautiful, and their relationship to reality. That these have always been terms, they feel so abstract, you know, the good, the true, and the beautiful, but they're things that are only read off, even though there is an abstraction to them. They're things that you only encounter and are read off the very face of things. And so one of the things you're talking about is like that encounter with the world, whether it be understanding a tree or whatever. I do think there's an orientation toward the reality. It's the reality that the world is good and beautiful. Like, in other words, that's not just a fact, you know, in your mind. That's not a bit of
right,
but that's a reality that your whole personhood is attuned to as a living reality, that in fact the world around me is good, which means my will is rightly pulsing toward it, that the world around me is true, which means my mind is rightly trying to pull it into myself to contemplate it. And there's a kind of intimacy with the world in contemplation to understand humans naturally desire to know, And it's not unfitting, in fact, in the tradition. Lots of philosophers have reflected on this, that the Bible can say Adam knew his wife and she conceived. The intimacy of knowledge in that particular sense doesn't ultimately leave, even when we're talking about epistemology, because epistemology is to experience what's being named in epistemology, in the study of the human knowing activity and the structure of it. What's being named in epistemology is the most intimate union that occurs in our experience between ourselves and the world, where we pull into ourselves the world outside of ourselves and are related to it in the mind. There's a fullness, and that's not just knowing data. That's being, to extend the metaphor, as it were, that's being naked to the inner intelligible shape of things in the world to ourselves.
Yeah.
That's what it means to know in the tradition. But the first movement, as well, in the tradition, you talk about the shine of a thing, the shine, what is beauty, is that just the encounter in the tradition. A lot of times the way beauty is named is the encounter with the thing that's not me. It's just the shine of being is just the infant's, the toddler's encounter with an object before the quantum wave collapse, where I go out and get a thing and stick it in my mouth. That's the will, like, what is this thing? And infants like stick it in their mouth because they're just trying to interact with it. Or the movement of knowing a thing. That's not me going out and getting something, but pulling that thing into the intimacy of my interior space. There's this interesting moment of beauty, which is just the encounter with a thing in itself. It's a pleasure in itself. Which is why infants, when they encounter a new thing, you're like, whoa.
Right. Right.
And the soul, in a sense, the rightly oriented soul, getting outside of our heads. And there's so many habits that shove us back into our heads. But the rightly oriented soul getting out of our heads is a soul that is open to the encounter with things, such that pulls you. That's the world itself, in a sense, pulls you into itself, rather than you being locked, as it were, inside of your own, the labyrinthine, circuitous game of the interior self, when it's not engaged with the world and in conversation and in a project with the world.
Yeah, I think really what you're, I think, yeah, that's very well said. And really, I think what we're saying here, in some broad sense, is the reciprocity. Creation functions as, springboards up to consider the maker, right? So all creation for everyone ever looking at creation has cast the mind higher to see from whence does all this come. Right. Okay. So if creation functions that way, then the consideration of creation, the careful consideration of the world, bringing the world in, but also being taken into the world, helps us to praise and thank God, the maker. And then the more we do that, the more we know ourselves. And then the more we know ourselves, we big, larger chunks of us are pulled back into the world and then therefore into God. And we know God more, and then we know ourselves more. And this is what it means, I think, really, when we talk about the pursuit of excellence, we're talking about arriving in glory. That's what we're talking about, the actualization of all potential things according to their nature being fully actualized. The actualization of all the potential in all of things is maxed out. It's fully actualized. So then if we can look at the world that way, which then springboards the mind up to God, then God is the source from where we can know more of ourselves, and so on and so forth. So I'm repeating myself. It's just a different way to say this reciprocity between God and ourselves, knowledge of God and knowledge of self, is the way that you can figure out your particular vocations and your particular potential that should be aimed at doing this excellently, right? Or doing that excellently. And I think we're using them in two different ways. In one way is the pursuit of the excellent is the pursuit of God. And in another way, the, you know, to pursue excellence is to do something well. And that means you're doing something, you're interacting with the world according to the way the world is. You're not maligning the world, but you're working harmoniously with the world to bring about some desired end, which is ultimately good, right? Yes, brother. Well, this has been an excellent conversation. Thank you, Joe. As always, you can find our previous episodes on the Davenant Institute YouTube page. You can also find us on any podcast medium that you'd like. We're also, you can find us on Spotify. So check out our previous episodes and please like and subscribe and share this if you find it helpful. But until next time, I love you, brother.
Love you, man.
And we'll see you all next time.
See ya.